Welcome to Change Hackers, providing daily insight and inspiration for people changing their world. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I invite you to join me today in conversation with someone on the front line of driving change and transformation. My guest today is Tim Balkin, CEO of IEMA, arguably the world's leading membership association for sustainability professionals, including chief sustainability officers from many of the world's leading companies. From humble beginnings as an apprentice service engineer with British Gas, Tim has overcome self-limiting beliefs to find his way to leading a global community of sustainability leaders. I spoke to Tim online from his office in the UK. So Tim, welcome to Change Hackers.
Thank you, good to be here.
The path you've been on is a pretty interesting one, and you're now in this situation where you're leading an organisation which is the home of, I guess, a global community of chief sustainability officers and people immersed in environmental assessment and auditing and so on. Looking back, I mean, when you started out on your career, had you got any idea that you'd end up doing what you're doing now?
Not in the slightest, and I don't think anybody around me would have had any inkling that I'd at some point become chief executive. In fact, I met up with there's a reunion of, I started life as an apprentice to British Gas as a service engineer. We had a reunion last year, and I think it was a shared opinion that I was probably the most least likely person ever to have become chief executive of anything, regardless of a sort of global
body. Based on their memories of what you were like back then.
Yes, and I have to say that was a pretty safe bet, I would say, as well.
When do you first recall sort of deciding that management leadership was the direction you wanted to go in?
I'm not sure when the moment was. I think I've always been an individual that if you take a step up, you then look at the next step. Mm. And it's a question of where that next step is. And it just so happened that the next step was leadership and management. And even in British Gas, which at the time was a nationalised industry, so it was a huge monolith of an organisation with huge structures. So you just looked at the next job. At that time, there were two choices. One was sales and one was, a supervisor role. The step I took was actually training and development, which was an unusual choice. And it just presented itself as an opportunity. And for me, it was another step up. So I just thought I'd go down that path. It was just promotion. It was just a step up, a new challenge. And it sounded quite interesting, really.
But it sent you down a whole different path.
I learned so much about interpersonal skills as being a trainer. And when you add that on to, I have a natural interest in people. And the bit I used to love about being a service engineer for British Gas, you could have a cup of tea, particularly with the older people, and you'd learn so much from their life and their history. Very often I used to spend sort of an hour and a half talking to old people and never get my jobs done. What I learned in training is some of the skills associated with that social interaction that I enjoyed. So it was, I didn't know it at the time, but it certainly was building on and give me a different perspective on not just engaging with people, but some of the things that you can do to engage people that you would find difficult. Mm-hmm. And that's the bit I enjoyed.
Have you always been a good listener?
Depends who you ask, I suppose. I think so. Yes, I suppose I am.
But you've enjoyed listening to people's stories or...
In the main, if people are trying to force their views on me, then I tend to struggle because I'm quite contrary. But when you listen to, some of the old people or even some of the young people that's done something inspiring, I can sit down and listen and just be... just awe-inspired by some of the stories that people have told me. And the interesting bit is they put it across as very ordinary. And when you listen to them, they're far from ordinary. And that I used to love listening to those stories. There are very rarely extraordinary people. You generally get ordinary people that do extraordinary things. Mm. And because most people regard themselves as ordinary, unless they're on some kind of ego trip, there's a sort of lovely humility about the way they present their stories.
Yeah.
And it's almost in passing, you know, and you think, wow, I'd be putting posters on the wall if I'd done what you'd done. And, you know, and it's just over a cup of tea or a beer or something like that. And, I just love those kind of stories.
So what did you learn about yourself then when you got into training?
It's interesting. When you look back on your own life, I suppose, you do things that you don't know why you're doing. You don't recognise them as traits that you have until you look back and think, yeah, you're old enough and you become a little bit wiser to understand those kind of things. And when I look back on my time as being a service engineer with the skills I had in training, I realised what I was doing and I was just learning from people. And I think the one asset I did have at that time, even though you are given all the kind of youthful stupidity that people have at that age, I had the ability to just learn from people's life. And it could be something absolutely trivial, innocuous, that you think, yeah, I'll bank that one, I'll remember that one. Or it could be something quite significant that would set you up for actually some quite profound changes in your life that's coming forward. So what training did, it helped me analyse why I positioned myself there. And actually, quite early on, I thought, yeah, this is a trait I really quite like. And you know what? I've probably got a little bit further than most people would have suggested because I had that ability to learn from other people. And I still do that.
Okay. So at what point did you start thinking, okay, so this is something I want to take quite seriously and I want to move my way up within this world?
Not till a long time after. So the thing about training, particularly a large company, it's almost a blind alley. You get stuck up there and you're not considered operational in any way. So if you get stuck there, there are very few places to go. And at that time, British Gas was moving from being a nationalised company and being split up into five companies. So the whole organisation was in turmoil. So, and it was a horrible period because I wasn't able to do the job I wanted to do, which I enjoyed doing. I wasn't able to get a different job because I was stuck with a kind of a tag. And I had to wait until British Gas resurfaced, and it resurfaced into five separate businesses. And there were 500 of us in training at that time. And I think there was 21 jobs that was on offer. And I just threw an application in, again, the next job up. It was almost a case of, well, this is what's available to me. I'll go for it, see what happens. But I didn't hold much hope out. And I got one of the jobs. And at that point, I'm then sat around a middle management network, albeit I was still in training. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, actually, I can handle my own here. It's not as, you know, these people at a management aren't a different animal at all. They're just like me and you and everybody else. But I had this concept that, you know, these are very bright, clever people who do some stellar things, and that wasn't the case.
So a self-limiting belief to some extent, but it's also the label identity thing, isn't it, in terms of how others perceive you, you know, what license that gives you to have an opinion on different things that are getting discussed around the table.
Oh, absolutely. I remember the first meeting with some senior managers, and the tactic was very clear. I'd go in there, keep my mouth shut and sit on my hands so I don't make any. And within about 5 minutes, I'm thinking, this is just absolute rubbish that they're talking. And I couldn't help myself. And the more I spoke, the more people listened. I thought, I'm not quite sure what's going off here. And it did take me a long time to understand what was going off and why I was able to make a contribution.
Because you call spades a spade, maybe?
Well, absolutely. You know, there were some, let's say, some very rough edges around there. But I just had this perception. I mean, you called it when you said self-limiting beliefs. You know, you have a belief that because I've been brought up from a working-class background, I'm in a working-class job, come from the blue-collar side, didn't go to university, did an apprenticeship. You have this belief that, this is not my network. And actually, that was complete nonsense.
So it's not until you're immersed in that network that you suddenly realise what a mirage that is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You do it by practice.
Yeah. Do you think that holds people back, good people back?
Absolutely. I think there's a there are people that have a sense of self-belief, and I'm overgeneralizing here, but you know, the people that go to a I suppose, have a good education or go to a good school, or even dare say a public school, they almost come out with self-belief of what they can do. When you come from a working class background, you almost have a self-limiting belief that you're taught. And actually, that is absolute nonsense on both counts. I believe everybody should leave education with this sense of belief. And, you know, education is there to help you achieve that belief, not hold you back.
So having got yourself into that situation for the first time, discovered that you could be outspoken and you'd be listened to, where did you go from there? I mean, you know, so you've made that transition, but how did you do it?
I still can't answer that. I still, I mean, you go to an interview and you give some pretty standard answers. What I thought was standard answers to some pretty standard questions. What I didn't realise, I suppose, looking back, because of the background I'd had, I was speaking with a lot of experience. I had that background. Mm. I'd come from that blue collar background, so I knew what I was talking about. Mm. Therefore, I developed some pretty strong ideas on how British Gas should be approaching their training education strategy, and how that's going to help them in the difficulties they were in at that particular time, because they'd fallen out with their customers at that time. So
this was,
for me,
sorry, just to be clear, this was an interview for what, a more of a general management role?
No, this was still in training. It was
Within British Gas.
Yeah, still in British Gas. And it was, all of a sudden, it was a kind of a middle to low management level. It didn't have staff at the time. Mm-hmm. So again, it's the, I suppose it was the path that that was open to me, and that was the only path open to me at that time. But I thought, yes, let's see what we can do. And what happened after that, actually, British Gas and I sort of fell out, because I got confidence in the experience I had, and I knew what it was like to be a service engineer. I knew what the customers were asking for. And I'd obviously got some experience in the training, therefore I had some fairly strong ideas on the things that we can do. I think at the time, and this is a point about transition, I think at the time British Gas was going through an awful lot of change. Mm-hmm. So I suppose knowing what I know now, I have much more sympathy with the, where the organisation was. But what I was surrounded by were people having opinions which I just thought were completely invalid, because they had nothing to back their opinions up from. They were working out of textbooks and theories and that kind of thing. And actually, as I got more frustrated, I got louder with my voice. And I didn't have the tools available to me then to be able to present an opinion or a view in a way that's more palatable and more influential. And I just become a loud voice, and both of us fell out with each other. I think what I was saying was right, but it was done in an unhelpful way. Yeah. And you can look back at that time and you can think, yeah, okay, I would have played my cards very differently had I known then what I know now.
We're all wiser with hindsight, aren't we?
So
where did you go from there?
So I vowed never to go into the gas industry and never to go into training again.
And that's exactly what you did.
I had a year out, but that's exactly what I did. So I did manage to have a couple of other jobs, and then I was sat in the marketing team, and one of the women in the marketing team said, "This job's written for you," and it was chief executive of what was then called the National Training Organization. So it was chief executive of a National Training Organization, which I'd never heard of before.
Yeah.
And this was a strategic body that looks at professional standards, occupational standards for the gas industry. So I know this inside out. And the job advert was very unusual. So the job advert read something like, "This is a 2-year secondment for somebody young and up and coming. We don't want somebody that's been there, got the T-shirt and have experience of being chief executive. We want to give somebody a chance." And that was the only reason I applied for it. And I thought, this is a strange advert. And I was very reticent about applying, because it was the same people that I'd turned my back on not long before. And I remember the night before, I remember it very well, I'm saying to my wife, "I really don't want to go here, because it's the same people that are now. I don't want to work for them." Except I didn't know the chair. It was a new name.
Right.
And my wife, you know, these months of wisdom where you say, just go to the interview, see how it goes. And within 2 minutes of sitting down, I just looked at this guy and thought, I can learn an awful lot from you, and wanted the job at that point.
So at no point were you kind of daunted by the prospect of interviewing for a CEO job, having never had one before, having come from a sort of lower middle management role? You know, was this just another promotion? And you just took it in your stride that it was a CEO role?
Certainly not quite. I wasn't daunted because I didn't understand what a CEO did.
Okay.
So it just looked pretty, okay, I can do
Chief
this.
Chief engineering officer.
Absolutely. You know, you think,
I can do engineering.
Why not? And I remember when they offered me the job and I rang my sister and I said, I've got a new job and it's a chief executive. And she said, oh, Tim, what on earth have you just done? And it took me 6 months to work out why she said that.
Right. Was that an informed insight or was it just a...
Yes, because I was literally clueless on what the executive did, and obviously, as I've just said, I'd not really got any leadership skills at all. I'd got strong opinions and I'd got a few, but I really hadn't had any experience of leading people, let alone an organisation, and let alone a strategic one at that.
Part of the clue is in the advert that they posted, but they were clearly looking for something different rather than predictable.
Oh, there were, and it was a pretty of a, it was a very rough ride, actually. So they knew I wasn't at the level they wanted at that time, but that's what the advert said. So they wanted, so the philosophy there was, let's give somebody a chance to be chief executive, then throw them back into industry, and then we'll train somebody again. That was the philosophy. And after about 6 months, I can remember thinking, you know, I just can't do this. This is too hard. And I can remember going into a meeting with the chairman and I'd got myself prepared for a speech that said, look, really thanks for the opportunity, but, you know, this perhaps was one step too far for me. And I think I got about halfway through the first sentence when the chair just looked at me and he says, don't lose your confidence. We're going to be okay. And you go back to yourself and you think, well, okay, I'll trust this guy. And this guy was one of the best coach and mentors that I've ever come across. And about 2 years after that, I can remember having a beer with him. And I did manage to find my feet, and we did some incredible stuff in actual fact. And I said, why did you back me at that point? Because he was getting some stick from his board about why he'd appointed me in the first place. He says, I know you had the capability. It was just a question of when, not if. But you couldn't lose your self-belief. That would have been fatal. And I've carried that lesson with me for the rest of my life.
That's really powerful. I mean, thank God for you had someone like that.
Minding
your back.
Oh, you know, I mean, I see it here. I see it in AEMA. I see people with these limiting beliefs where... You're almost given a, can't quite find the right word. You're given a duty to pass on that kind of faith and belief in people.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing you ask for is that they go with you, that they commit to the journey. And I've had examples where I've been able to repair that to individuals. Who have done things that they would have never dreamed that they were capable of doing. But also, at the same time, I've given opportunities to people where they've not made it also. So, you know, and I'll keep trying that. And I've, you know, like my boss, like my chair at the time, I've come under criticism as to why I've decided to be patient with certain people. And you know what? It's a criticism I'm very happy to take now and in the future.
You know, for most people who... kind of climb their way up through their career, you know, just about everybody has self-doubt, has self-limiting beliefs in one shape or another that hold them back, that they regard as a weakness themselves, that they sometimes try and conceal from others. And yet, you know, supported in the right way, with as you described, you know, someone in a position to provide you with just the right word here and there, and the right kind of, you know, backing when you need it. ends up turning you into a much more effective leader as a consequence, not least because you've got empathy with people who are coming through behind you in terms of the kind of stuff that they're wrestling with.
Absolutely. What you described there is a sort of almost as though your ego gets in the way and prevents you from asking for help at times. And I'm seeing this actually even now. And you know, we're not all perfect. We've not all got the right answer. And it's perfectly okay not to have the right answer. And as a leader, I would expect, you know, my leadership team to demonstrate their leadership skills by saying, I need some help around here. I'm stuck on this problem. What do you think? And, you know, getting people in a comfortable place to be able to do that is really quite hard, you know, because there's a lifetime of learning that they've had where they may have had a different response to that. So there's a trust and a learning that is not easy to do.
Well, why is it, do you think, that particularly the media generally kind of perpetuate this view of leadership that it's infallible and that it's heroic? And has all the answers.
Well,
it seems the opposite's true half the time. You know, the strength is to reveal your vulnerability.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a nonsense to think a politician, for example, and I'll be a little bit generous with politicians at the minute, but it's a nonsense to think they will never get it wrong. They'll never make a mistake, and they will. And yet, you know, the slightest thing, particularly now with social media, you know, we can go back years and years and find out a comment or a lack of judgment in some kind of areas. I go back to my days when I was at British Gas, and I remember I'd made a mistake, I think, with a boiler or something like that. But one of the older guys put his arm around me and says, you know, Tim, those that's never made a mistake have never done a job. And they're the kind of little lessons that you fall back to and think, yeah, I'm okay making mistakes as long as I get more right than wrong and I continue to learn. Personally, I'm quite comfortable with it. But
so let's talk now about the organisation that you're presiding over as chief exec now, IEMA. So the position you inherited, the culture you came into, the organisation that was when you walked in through the door. The organisation that's there now bears almost no resemblance to what you took over. It's been through a big transformation, both in terms of membership base, in terms of mission, vision, and the team itself. And just sort of take us through that journey in terms of, you know.
So I had a year off work, actually. So I'd just come from running a sector skill council, and we achieved some fantastic stuff there and had a really good team. And I had a year off, and then I come into IEMA. And I remember walking through the door, and my very first thought was, wow, I wonder where the capability is going to come from here, because everybody looked about 17.
Okay.
And then you start asking questions around, you know, why do we have so many apprentices? Why are there so many young people? And the answers were uncompelling at best. And really, when you boiled it down to it, it was because every decision was made on lowest cost basis. And you think, right, okay, that's not going to create the best value, but I'll just hold that one to one side. As one of the things I did actually was I'd arranged beforehand with my PA at the time to schedule in 30-minute conversations with small teams. And it wasn't about work. It was, I just want to know you as a person. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to tell you about my life. You'll tell me about yours. Tell me what you're interested in. Tell me what it's like working here. It was kind of a conversation. And it was really interesting because people were absolutely inspired by the purpose of the organization, bit frustrated by how it did it. And actually, we found exactly the same answer with our members. You know, I love IEMA, it's fantastic, but you know, it really frustrates me at times. I suppose I'd go back to the first part of this interview. I think IEMA at that time had a very strong self-limiting belief about what it could achieve. And it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it was surrounded by people who wouldn't allow it to make mistakes. So therefore, that embedded that culture of, well, let's not try to do too much, then we're not going to get hurt if we get things wrong. So there was the culture that was basically a self-taught culture that said, let's stick to what we're doing that we know best, then we're not, nobody's going to fear, nobody's going to get hurt. And when you sit and talk to your members about some of the things that they're doing, all our members said they want to change the world. You know, they're very passionate about this. Mm-hmm. And the culture of our members were saying, we're just worlds apart. And we said, you know, we've got to change this. And everything I know about AIM, and it had achieved some absolutely fantastic things, but it didn't recognize the really good things it achieved. And you think, you know what? If organizations had achieved what you guys have done, they would be singing from the rooftops. So why don't we actually start to lift our head above our shoulders here and stick our chests out, be very proud of what we've achieved so far, and let's go on to change the world. And that's what we set about doing.
But that, given where you started from, can't have been an easy journey at all. You'd have the backing of the membership to give you the license to do what you needed to do. But where do you start with the team?
Generally speaking, if you ask somebody an open question about what could AIM achieve, I mean, at that time we did a roadshow. We said, okay, let's go and talk to members. Let me introduce myself to the members, and we asked three questions. You know, what's AIM like for you? Mm-hmm. What's the elephant in the room? And what does a really good professional body look like? And we started to get some really interesting answers. So the elephant in the room at the time was sustainability, and it was almost universally that AIM should be doing sustainability, and it tends to focus on the environment. But right, okay, why have we got stuck in this debate? And that's another question. So we then said, what does a really good professional body look like? What our members were asking to do at the time is, look, they want to change things, you know, whether it be their work environment, whether it be their boss, whether it be their CEO, their local communities, their cities, their countries. They just wanted to change things and make things better than where they are with regards to environmental sustainability. And we said, well, why can't we do this? What's stopping us? And you go back to self-limiting belief. Yes, but to, you know, there's only 35 of us. No. There's about 14,500 of our members, and actually that's enough to create a significant change. So we said, oh, let's go for this, you know, absolutely.
But go for what, though? Become a campaign-focused organisation, or they're in support of the members who are trying to change the world, helping them figure out, well, how do we help you change the world?
Yeah, it was more about how we help. I mean, we're not a campaigning organisation. That's there are other people better placed to do that. And we have to remember, you know, we are a professional body. There's a sort of terms that we work within. But in our terms of reference, okay, let's see what we can achieve here. And it's very clear that we can't change the world on our own. So, okay, let's be mature about this. Who are the partners? Who are we going to work with? And that was another change in culture. There wasn't a culture of how do we engage other people to create a partnership where we both benefit from this. You know, it was a very insular looking organization at that particular point in time. And there was some vested interest here as well, which had to be unlocked.
So what's your sense? I mean, because a lot of the listeners will be by definition change agents in their own right at different points in their career, and will in that sense relate strongly to your membership. So what's your sense of where your members get the most frustrated?
Oh, it's knowing they can make a change and make a difference, and not being allowed to make that change. You know, even you speak to people who perhaps, let's say, have a compliance type job or a relatively new job into the profession. It's the first job or something like that. So they come armed with lots of knowledge and lots of enthusiasm. And then what happens is the way corporates work is we sort of squeeze the life out of that kind of interest because we want to put them into a corporate way of working. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, we start talking in a corporate kind of a way. And I go back to my days at British Gas, you know, you're a small voice in a big organization. You don't actually get anywhere unless you're able to position that. So for me, it was about saying, okay, How do we equip you with the tools and techniques that I didn't have when I was starting out in my career, which is why I ended up leaving British Gas? How do we equip you with those tools so you can better place your argument, make you more influential, to make you more compelling, and the way you position your argument far more plausible than I can remember the way I used to position arguments when I was younger? So that's where we're working on. And at the top level, it's about creating that leadership. Where do people look to that says, okay, look, this sustainability agenda, it's all well and good, it's all very fancy, but you know, we have a business to run. Now, when we can point to a whole group of people, which currently is our fellows and our full members, that these are people that's actually done it and they've got experience of it and are continuing to make business benefits as well as social and environmental benefits, you start to use the examples people have got, and it's a very compelling story. And what's interesting about that, it's not AEMA telling the story. AEMA may tell the story, of course, but it's not AEMA's story. It's the story that we have of our members that we are then aggregating together. And that's where the power of the voice starts to come together.
Yeah, I can see that. So there's, I mean, you're holding space, really, aren't you? To bring members together to share their stories, that then embolden each other. And help to unpick some of these self-limiting beliefs. So I wonder what extent your background in training has played into your approach to the kind of shape of the organisation and its way of working now.
It's not so much training, I think, they brought in. I think it's the learning experience I had rather than training experience. Right. So you look at our, if you have knowledge as a commodity, for example, you know, we've got 14,500 people with a very valuable commodity. Now, if we were to start to share that commodity and offer that around freely, then, you know, all of a sudden you become very influential. So it's that ability to learn and share knowledge. Where my background really starts to hit into this is, you know, I'll go back to the chairman who backed and supported me, and it's around that mentoring and coaching and saying, look, I've known individuals here that's been absolutely passionate about climate change, for example, and are really frustrated that they can't get the world to listen to their arguments, even though their argument is based on science, it's rock solid, and, you know, it stacks up against anybody's argument. Yet for some reason, it doesn't create that kind of a change. No, okay. Let's go to some of our fellows. How have they learnt to create change in their organisation? It's not by shouting. It's by understanding the person that they're talking to, understanding their motivations, being able to learn a bit about them as individuals or organisations, and then being better able to seed their learning, their arguments and their positions. That's where, I suppose, you look at my background and you look at what my first chairman taught me. There were the skills that are absolutely invaluable to this journey that we're on.
I think that's such an important piece of insight, really, in terms of that ability to be able to. It's beyond listening. It's about really deeply sensing where someone's coming from, what their perspective is, what their values are, and then having the agility to be able to reframe your language in ways. And I can't help wondering, I mean, of all the different experiences and things you've been exposed to over the years, whether your roots sort of come to the fore again, actually, in terms of that it's almost like an innate ability, because, you know, coming from a working class background and now in a senior leadership position in a, you know, networking with many, many very educated people, you know, you've acquired the skill over time of being able to adapt your language to talk to just about anybody.
And I think you have to. I think it communication is a two-way process. It's about giving and receiving. And very often, as I've got better in a leadership position, I do far less talking. I do far more listening. And more often than not, you only need to ask one question and people will tell you the answer. You know, you've got a difficult, you have a difficult conversation with a member of staff, for example, at this level, and 99 times out of 100, you don't need to tell them that what they're doing is not asking. You just ask them the question, they know the answer. So then you can help them. And it moves the relationship. It starts to build that trust. And you go back to organizational way corporates behave, because corporates have a personality too. And it's about understanding personalities of that corporate. And if you understand that personality, then you can start to say, okay, who's pulling the levers of the personality? What is it that's driving them as individuals? Let me see if I can help you with your personality. All of a sudden it becomes, you don't have an argument because you're both on the same side of the conversation. What you have then is how to drive forward an agenda where everybody can benefit from. And that's about that reframing and that. But you can't reframe unless you listen.
Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks for joining us on Change Hackers.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much indeed.
I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I'm on a mission to provide inspiration and insight for people changing their world. So check out changehackers.org to read show notes, guest blogs, and subscribe to access bonus content. Remember, this show's for you and change hackers like you. So drop me a line, tell me what you love, what you hate, or ideas you have for improving the show. And let me know if you know someone who'd make a great guest on this show. Maybe a friend, someone you work with, maybe even you. Just use the contact form at changehackers.org. I'd love to hear from you. Till next time, Change Hackers.